Hey there, everybody. I just wanted to jump in before the actual recording here to let you know why you're seeing an episode in the middle of the month instead of at the beginning. Some time ago, I had put out a plea for people to sign up for some of the shorter Hugo winners, just so I could get them done in advance of a vacation that I had planned for this summer. We were going to be traveling to watch our son in the Olympic swimming trials this summer, but of course, that was all pushed out a year. So I've got a couple episodes that are burning holes in my pockets, and I don't want to just sit on them. So I'm going to be releasing them out of cycle. So I'll be doing two a month for just the next couple of months. So consider these episodes a COVID-19 bonus, and I hope you enjoy them. And with that, I'll hit the intro music. Hi there, and welcome back to the Hugo's There podcast. I'm your host, Seth Heasley, and I'm reading the Hugo winners one guest at a time. My guest for this episode is Matt from Upper Pylon 2, and we are going to be talking about Arthur C. Clarke's Rendezvous with Rama, which won the 1974 Hugo Award for Best Novel. So, Matt, thank you for joining me.
Oh, thank you. It's absolutely my pleasure. I don't get an opportunity to talk about books in any real deep form with anybody, so I've been kind of really looking forward to this opportunity with you.
Awesome. Well, I've been looking forward to it, too. So, why don't you tell people about your background in podcasting and a little about yourself?
Sure. So my main podcast has been Upper Pylon 2, a Star Trek Deep Space Nine review podcast. I was one of the founding members of that podcast, and it was a weekly review show looking at every episode of Deep Space Nine in the order that they were released. And the way we kind of looked at that is, like, we were huge fans of Star Trek. We love it, but we weren't going to do, like, that extreme polarization of fandom where you have to defend everything. We looked at it as very honest kind of barroom discussion. We got really silly at points, tried to be really deep and thoughtful if the episode really demanded that and earned that kind of a discussion. And it really was just, you know, it wasn't a rage or, you know, super hate show or over the top praise. It was just a lot of fun. And one of the things we always really prided ourselves on, if you got one of those really stinker episodes, we really tried our best to try, like, how would we fix this? What would we do different? And I swear we came up with some ideas that were better than what was put to screen. And in the end, we managed to do every single episode, and we put out review episodes to wrap up each season and one final one to wrap up the entire show. And we actually hit our mission accomplished, and we put it out there for everybody to hopefully continue to discover over the years. It was a real fun experience with, and I made some really good friends throughout the course of that show.
Nice. I was a latecomer to Deep Space Nine, other than when I guess I watched the first season, or at least part of it, when it first came out. But it took me some time to get back to it. In fact, it was just in the last 3-4 years. So, and I listened to a couple Deep Space Nine podcasts, yours among them. So,
yeah, thanks. We always thought it was, like, the best show. And it's one of those maybe rare TV shows where when we looked at, I kept every single score that we gave every episode and did all the math throughout the run. And I could show with our scores, it continuously got better every season as it came out. And it's like, I don't know how many shows can really ever say that. Maybe Star Trek specifically maybe runs into those kind of problems. But it was a real fun show to review.
Yeah. Well, what about you? What's some of your history, as I call it, your nerdy history?
It's extensive. I'll kind of I'll just say that because, and it will bend in specifically to this book here. So, I grew up an '80s kid, you know, raised on television. I watched RoboCop way earlier than I ever should have, and you know, I always drifted as a real young kid towards genre cartoons or the associated toys. But I remember very distinctly my first moment where it all kind of clicked. I was 7 years old. It was, I can put an exact date on it, June 17th, 1991, because I was sitting on the floor at my dad's feet and I was just playing, you know, goofing around with whatever. And my dad, who isn't really a big Star Trek fan, was watching an episode of Star Trek Deep Space Nine. It was Redemption, presumably the date it premiered. And he wasn't even that big of a fan, but when they had the big shocking moment where Tasha Yar's half Romulan daughter shows up, I can remember the exact quote. My dad said, "Hey, that's the woman from before." He couldn't even get the character or, you know, the actress's name right. But for whatever reason, I was insanely hooked on it, because there was some fighting in that episode too, I think. But that last thing at the end really caught me, because it was a dun-dun-dun moment. And that was season four. By season seven, I was devastated when the show was coming to an end. And then just from there, it was insatiable. I watched every single thing I could, Star Trek, every movie, awful 90s syndicated science fiction. You know, I watched religiously and was also so hurt when Sequest or Earth 2, you know, these network science fiction shows fell off the air. But I wasn't really all that big of a reader then. I did dip a little bit into Arthur C. Clarke, because it's like when you're first getting in, like, who are some of the names? And I was a huge 2001 fan. So I started to read a little bit of that, but it really kind of fell away until I was it. But, you know, all this science fiction stuff translated to real science, and that ended up being my career path. And I did a doctorate in cancer pathology, a postdoc in cancer therapeutics. And to this day, I can say that that is, I can draw a line all the way through that it was Star Trek on that day at my dad's feet that did it. It's a complete through line for me. But then cut to me being 25 in grad school, I think, March 19th, 2008, Arthur C. Clarke died. Almost 12 years to the day of this recording, by the way. And just something clicked in my head, and I wanted to, like, I cut back to, like, reading his books, like a couple of them. And on a whim, I just picked up Rendezvous with Rama and basically read it in one sitting. And again, literally from that date, it's been chain reading ever since. The moment I finish one book, I pick up the next. And so from that date, you know, about 12 years ago, I've now read hundreds of books. I literally have a library of 2,000 paperbacks. And it's all directly connected to Arthur C. Clarke and this very book that we're going to talk about tonight.
Right. And that leads nicely into, you know, kind of why this book. I know you threw out a few titles when we were first talking about getting a recording in.
Yeah. So there's a handful of them in there. And I've, like I said, I've been trying to, like, kind of do very casually what you're doing here. I want to hit all the big historical ones, find all these weird forgotten to history things, and going through what hasn't been covered yet. A lot of them are, you know, ones Forever War, Hyperion, Ender's Game, stuff I just absolutely love, where can't blame people for taking that. But then when I saw this one there and with that story, I'm like, oh, how could it be anything other than this, really, in the end? I threw out some ones just in case somebody called this one, but this was going to be the decision I want, because it's, I mean, like I said, I'm going to try and apply that same kind of thing about, like, the Star Trek podcast. I really love this book. It's super important, but I want to have, like, that kind of honest discussion around it here. And I think there's a great opportunity for that.
Yes, definitely. Well, and the other side of this is I had put out an appeal for people to sign up for some of the shorter ones, just because I needed to do some recording in advance of some vacation that I'm going to be taking this summer. And so you were nice enough to throw out a couple of the shorter titles, or one like Rendezvous with Rama that was a previous read for me that I could pick up pretty quickly. So I thank you for that.
And this was a previous read for me, but 12 years ago. And I've now chain read, like I said, so much, all of it kind of falls together, unfortunately. I conflate a lot of the books, so I'm really happy I got to go back and reread this one.
Cool. Well, why don't we go ahead and move into the kind of non-spoiler discussion about Rendezvous with Rama. Can you give a quick non-spoiler synopsis / elevator pitch?
Astronauts explore a massive alien ship. That quick enough for you? Yeah. I mean, that's the book.
It is. Yes. It's kind of the quintessential big dumb object book, right?
It's, yeah, I mean, that's one of the ones that, like, I'll kind of argue with, because when we do the who else might like this novel, this is like one of those cornerstone books in there.
Yeah.
Quintessential? Well, I think we can kind of talk about that a little bit.
Okay. Yeah, sounds good. Well, why don't we move right into that, talking about who might like the novel, and then we'll kind of go into overall thoughts about it.
Sure. So this one, I'm going to throw a lot out there. A lot of it might sound more dismissive of the book than it should, but I really don't want it to sound like that. But first one is, you know, going back, I think a lot of my stuff is influenced through Star Trek, and probably a lot of science fiction, you know, fans in general, it's all from that kind of a launching point. But I think people who like Star Trek episodes, this is could be rebranded as one. And,
yes,
you know, in the crew of the week, whatever show, kind of explore it, because it's basically kind of a anomaly of the week. It's kind of a nice light adventure with only moderate stakes. And it's just kind of jump in, jump out. There was a kind of a nice little self-contained package of, isn't that kind of neat kind of a thing, right?
Yeah, definitely. And even when I think about kind of visualizing Rama, I picture it like the probe in Star Trek IV.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Strong connection there. Yeah, I was just looking for that little dangling lit up orb at the bottom of it.
Yes, definitely.
And then the next one, it's right where you hit on, I think, the big dumb object, or like it's a subsection in science fiction of the mega structure, the alien mega structure. Yeah. That's just mind boggling. So like, that's one of the things that keeps bringing me back to the Star Wars Expanded Universe books, even though I really dislike all of them every time. It's because like the Death Star, the mega star destroyers, like all that kind of stuff I find so evocative.
Yeah.
I'll pitch one here that it's kind of forgotten to time, but I love the Cage World series by Colin Capp. Hmm. That's just like super fun. There's four of them and it's just such goofy adventure. But yeah. Here's where I would argue of like, I think they're both cornerstones, but maybe the most essential is the Ring World.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right.
And in fact, as soon as I said it, I thought, I think Ring World came out before this one and
oh,
I hadn't looked, but
that is one of my things I'm going to talk about in non-spoiler. Okay. And then like Halo fans who love those giant ships.
Yes.
And then
absolutely
kind of moving on to like the next one is like fans of like, sorry to say it, but kind of like the drier, hard science fiction, because this book is, it's Arthur C. Clarke more often than not. I've kind of found he's less concerned with the characters.
Yes.
And even maybe the action per se than his focus on his ideas or like his kind of politics kind of a thing. So if you're into like this, the ship is more important than the person, this is one of those books for you, I think.
Yes.
And this is the one I was debating whether I should mention, is like people who like just reading like the Wookiepedia or Wikipedia entries on stuff where it's more of a just a, this is the events that happen, kind of a run through of it, rather than you get the full flavor of all the characters involved in it. Again, that's where I'm like, that sounds a little overly critical of the book, and I don't really want it to sound like that.
Mm-hmm.
And then the last one is like, because of that, this is like, I can't do audiobooks because my mind wanders. And before I know it, I hadn't paid attention to the past chapter and a half. Mm-hmm. This one, if you're a little bit more like that, I think you can kind of get away with it here, because it's, you're not going to miss some major character switch or somebody now is acting suddenly different than they did a couple pages earlier. I think it's a little bit more of a kind of a straightforward kind of a book.
Yes, definitely. And I did listen to this one on audio to refresh for the podcast, because I'd gotten it from Audible a few years ago. And I will say it's not a great audiobook. The performance on it is very dry. And as I was listening to it, I was like, but it is kind of appropriate. The way the guy almost just reads it robotically, except when it's in a character, in dialogue. But all the prose parts are very flat. And I think it could be appropriate for this book.
Well, I mean, when you go and look at the prose, like, how do you make it sound more interesting when he's like, there's portions of it where it's literally reading square kilometer area to you and stuff like that. It's like, it's a little tough. And because like, I love Arthur C. Clarke, but he isn't necessarily a guy that turns a beautiful phrase a lot of the times. So it's, where is the room to make it a little bit more dramatic in your reading? So I didn't listen to it. So that's also a good clarification from you on that.
Yeah. I will say that, you know, Clark, I think I haven't really read that much Clark. I read Childhood's End and 2001 and 2010. And I do feel like he is one of those guys, like you mentioned, that is more about the big idea. And he wants to throw it out there and present it and go, hey, what are the implications of this? But then he doesn't talk through all of it. Like, there's so much stuff in this book that you could spend an entire book expanding on, and he doesn't do it. He's not interested in doing that. He just wants to bring up the concept and let it marinate in your mind. And then, you know, and so the characters are just there as these little proxies to create things to happen.
Yes. So this is where so much of what I'm going to want to talk about is kind of that writing style of it. And it's kind of hard to distinguish that from spoiler to non-spoiler. So this is where the conversation might be a little tricky into the spoiler territory, I think. But before we get into that, like, I think there's a few other things that we can talk about, like Clark style, without getting too much into the spoiler territory. I will say that I there's always room for just very optimistic views of the future. And I think that's Clark a lot of times. Like, bad stuff might happen in it, but I think he tends to look very optimistically towards science, how humanity will utilize it. So if you're, you know, there isn't the bad guy necessarily in a lot of his books, because I think he's looking at that as, you know, technology, and that will see us clear of a lot of those things in the future. So I do like that. And it's like, when you read, you know, modern books or, you know, modern whatever, you're always expecting somebody to be the, you know, Carter Burke character from Aliens, of like, you know, damn it, Burke, you know, the traitor. There isn't that, because people are kind of usually fundamentally good in his stuff. And I think that is kind of refreshing, going back and reading a very optimistic book from time to time.
Well, and I can appreciate that you just brought in a reference to a movie with Michael Biehn in it, because that was one of the things that we bonded on. on Twitter.
I'm going to be a fan forever when we shared our Michael Biehn love.
Yep. Definitely. Trying to think how much more to cover in non-spoiler before we just move on.
Okay, I'll throw out one more thing. Because this is like a Clarkism, I think, that he does excel in, usually pretty well. It's, again, tying it back to Star Trek, too often in my mind, aliens are depicted as a caricature of like a human quality. Look at the Klingons.
Yes.
I think they're a cartoon.
Sure.
And I always really love books where aliens are truly alien, where you just don't know what their motivation is, because how could you guess what their motivation is if they are completely independently, you know, developed from us, or, you know, away from us? And I think Clark does a pretty good job a lot of times with that, where it's like they're unapproachable. You can't even like scrape the surface of really what their intentions are. Like, this kind of falls into that 2001, whatever those monolith aliens are, are that, to an extent. Fountains of Paradise, you know, introduces like a very kind of enigmatic alien species in that. And then Childhood's End is another one of those ones where it's like, I think he does a pretty good job of going down that route of, they're just not the same old kind of, you know, cliche type of alien type of thing. It's something that does invoke a bit of like mystery or awe, or, you know, just confusion. You should be confused by aliens more often, I think, than what we typically see.
Yes, absolutely. Alrighty. So real quick, before we get into spoilers, how about, I realize we didn't really do kind of overall thoughts. I kind of skipped over that. So kind of overall thoughts from you about the book from your first time reading it and on the reread.
So first time reading it, like I said, it launched me on all this. So it definitely was super evocative, I'll say. Like, Clark might not have had the language to truly make you picture how big this is, because he created a world that was just so crazy. Like, it's tough to truly get it until you look up some artwork. And I did. And it really kind of like got that, the juices flowing of, this stuff is kind of exciting, kind of a thing. Yeah. So first time reading, I do remember it being quite well. Now, jumping back into this now, hundreds of books later, spanning all these decades and all these writing styles, this is something I'll pose to you maybe at the end of, does it stand the test of time? Because it's such a interesting way that it's written, and we'll dive into that more in spoiler section, that it's, my feelings on it are a lot more complex now, I would say. That said, it's one of the smartest authors out there in science fiction, I would say, writing something that is pretty cool. So I still think it's very much worth reading, and I did very much like going back and revisiting it.
Yeah. So for me, I think, you know, I've talked at length about my history of where I didn't read for a long time, and then I tried to become a more well-read science fiction fan. And this was one of the books that was on the lists that people would give me. And So when I finally did get around to reading it, you know, I saw, oh, well, it's not even a very big book, you know? And so I read it over a weekend and I was kind of like, yeah, it didn't make much of an impression on me. And it certainly, I remember not enjoying it as much as something like 2010 or 2001 is fine, but 2010 I actually like better as a novel. But so I was looking at this one and I was like, okay, I'll revisit it on audio and we'll see, you know, what we see. And it's still kind of one of those things where I'm like, I'm not sure that I'm into hard science fiction. And that could be the problem.
Mm.
Because the books, when I look over the ones that have really had a big impact on me, they're the more character-driven things. And like we've been saying, right? That's not Clark.
Yeah. I mean, that's where I'm kind of at now. It's of like, I don't want to say I'm world-wise or anything like that, but I've gotten older. I'm looking to dive into like reading into characters' interpretation or intentions of just trying to figure them out and deconstruct them a little bit through more complex character stuff. And that's just not this. And, you know, there's other hard science fiction books that are a little bit better than that, than, you know, they can still put in character stuff, because people describe like Ringworld as hard science fiction too, because the depth of the math around the Ringworld and the shadow squares and all that, but you still got your, you know, the women characters aside, you got really standout aliens, like super standout aliens, and rather interesting humans. So you don't have to kind of, well, I would argue hard science fiction doesn't have to be this. You can have your cake and eat it too.
I agree.
It's tough. It's more difficult to find that, I think.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Even something like The Martian, right? Which is definitely hard science fiction, but it's also very funny and you really engage with that main character.
So, right.
Cool. Okay. Yeah. How about we just move straight into spoilers and we can just, you know, whatever you want to talk about, we can talk about.
So this is where I think we go back into that style, because the kind of cutting right to the chase, nothing happens in this book.
Right.
It's kind of a harsh way of putting it again, but it's kind of a good thing and it's kind of a bad thing in how he writes, because I alluded to it with the Star Trek episode of only moderate stakes.
Right.
Clark is like, I kind of think he's like Tolkien in his writing, where it's he wants to tell you his things and it's not his fault that you're interested in something else. Because like Tolkien was interested in languages and the hobbits and all those songs. He was, and it, there just happened to be giant battles in his book. And I remember reading that going like, why can't we talk about the battle? Why are they having second lunch? You know? Right. And it's like, that's kind of a thing. And that I think is Clark here. He does create these situations, and we could run through a list of them here that are the potential to be super dramatic, but the way he writes, he's just not interested in, you know, the drama around it. It's like, I was shocked that no character dies in this or is left behind, because wouldn't you think that's like a natural stakes that is put into the book of like, oh no, we did step too far. Maybe we shouldn't be exploring this. Why didn't that guy who flew the little,
the air bike?
Yeah, I kind of envision it as like a dragonfly type of wing thing. Why didn't he just eat it at some point on the trip? So that's kind of like where I think one could really have this as a hit against the book. And going through Goodreads, there are plenty of people that do say that. It's like, where is like the action?
Where's the drama?
Right.
Too.
Yeah. Because it's like he creates it again, the Mercury people sending the missile to the ship. And that's about as dramatic as it gets, but it was still a pretty easy fix. There was only like a couple moments of it, the literal ticking bomb scenario. So, you know.
He wasn't real interested in developing that threat.
Right. And it's like you kind of sit there and go, why wasn't he? Like, it just kind of seems like that's a very natural thing. Mm-hmm. And then, to your point, one of the ones that was like, I have notes because I went through chapter by chapter and wrote thoughts of like, oh, surely this must be coming up later. You said like he throws out ideas that you can do a whole book around the simps.
Right.
You know, that is like again, where I think he's just so dang optimistic about technology that, like, oh, no, there is no ethical issue. We got this down so well about creating somewhere in between, like, a very smart chimp or a very dumb human.
Right.
And then using them for manual labor. I was wondering, like, when are they going to have, like, a dangerous situation and they're going to send a simp in? Because they're expendable. And then the guy who is the simp master, like, where is his argument with the captain of, like, you can't do this. This is unethical. Yeah. That does not happen whatsoever at all in the book. The simps are just, if they made a movie, they would be just literally in the background walking around every once in a while, picking up stuff. That's the level that they're in this, other than the chapter where he explains that in the future, we're going to be awesome and we're going to have these creatures that work for us.
Yeah. Yeah. I actually, it had been a number of years since I read this one. Not sure how many years, but a number of years. And so when, let's see, what was the name? I'm trying to think what the name of the guy who rode the dragonfly.
James Pack.
Right. Yeah. So when he was on that mission, I remembered he crashes at some point. Does he survive that? No, I don't think he survives it. You know, I think he gets left behind. And then like you said, that is not what happens. And in Galaxy Quest, right? Like, how do you know that the stakes are high without somebody dying early on, right?
Yeah. Or even at the end, because there's a part that I think would be super cinematic. It's when they're, well, I mean, there's a bunch. The whole setting is actually, you know. But when they are trying to evacuate the station and it's like the lights are shutting down and all this is happening, like, how did it, and they're all scrambling up this outrageous, mind-boggling staircase that ends up going vertical at a point. Like, how do they not lose somebody there? And, like, the captain's reaching his arm through the closing door to pull somebody through. Like, it's like, no, they're out. You know, it's that kind of a situation. So I do want to kind of tie it back to Ringworld here, because you mentioned something and we might have had the exact same thought, and I'm curious to see if you did.
Okay.
So when I was looking at this and, like, before even reading it, I was coming up with some of the things that, like, oh, maybe I'm going to argue that this was, like, this is the first one of the giant dumb space object stories that came out. And then when I went through the Hugo list and I knew Ringworld won, I listened to your podcast for it, and I was kind of absolutely shocked that this came out several years after that. And that this book came out in the 70s, because when I read it, I kind of was like, just because I've read so many books through so many decades, this felt like, if I were to put it on a timeline without knowing anything, it felt like early 60s kind of a thing, because of the characters and, like, some of those old science fiction books that didn't win anything, they got hung up on, like, they had a really neat novel thing of, like, I'm going to explain atomics to somebody because my audience hasn't even heard of this before. So they just go way into too deep. And this kind of had that kind of a feeling. So I was, like, frankly shocked that this came out after Ringworld, which I think it has a little bit more, well, certainly has a lot more of that adventure of exploring these areas and the character aspects to it too.
Yes, definitely. I mean, there is something undeniably cool about the exploration part of the book, right? Where, at least on a first read for me, and a little bit on the second read too, just thinking about what it would feel like. And I'm putting myself into the character, right? It's not necessarily that the book is evoking it, but it's something you can do as a reader, right? Where I'm like, what would that be like to step into something that is ancient and empty and completely dark? Because I think back to, like, when I was a kid and I was afraid of going to the downstairs when the lights were off, right? And just, it's just kind of a visceral thing when I think about stepping through that airlock and then there's no lights on. And then when they start going out at the end too, it's kind of comes back full circle.
Yeah. I can draw an exact connection to having that feeling that I found evoked when reading this, because when Norton, the main, you know, basically the main character, the captain of the ship, he opens the door and he's gazing out into this. It is, like you said, this black void. Like, I flash back to being on a cruise ship over the horizon up in Alaska with a balcony that I could go out onto. And when you close that, like you had the lights from the ship that reach out into the haze just a couple feet. And then it's you just even looking straight down, you cannot see water more than 10 feet away from the ship. And then it's just darkness, like literally nothing else. And it freaked me out of just like, what's stopping me from just taking a step out there? And then you're just gone. And it gave you like that weird pit in your stomach, and it just made you feel queasy. And I just like had to step back inside. That's a kind of the things that he touches on in here. And like, there's one moment where he says the ship was so big and the space is so big, it wouldn't allow for any level of echoing. So it's just this completely unnatural sound of like, you don't notice maybe when you're in a room that sounds bouncing around. Here, when they talked, like just the quality of the way they talked or anything made noise, it just disappeared. It just drifted out into nothingness. And I found that kind of inherently creepy.
Yeah. Well, and two, then that comes into contrast when the water starts to thaw, the ice starts to thaw, where all of a sudden they're hearing the breakup. And that's the kind of thing where you're in a state that gets some cold weather, right?
Oh, yeah, a little bit. Yeah, here and there.
Yeah, whereas I'm from Alaska. And so,
You know,
all the rivers freeze over, the lakes freeze over. And if you haven't heard the sound of breakup, and that's what we call the early spring. We kind of go, you know, it goes winter, then breakup, then spring. And winter is very quiet when you're someplace that is snowed in for the entire winter.
Yeah.
And so all of a sudden, when you start hearing rivers again, it's the sound of spring, right? But there's that moment when, you know, you're walking along a trail and all of a sudden you hear this massive commotion because the river has started to break up. And they get to experience that in Rama.
Yeah.
Only on a much larger scale.
Yeah. Oh, that's a great point. I mean, I love that moment of, I go out in the middle of the night to like shovel the driveway if we get a bad storm, just so my wife can get out in the morning. And when you take a moment from that and it's midnight, 1 a.m. in a blizzard, it is just this eerie quiet. There is you don't hear any cars anywhere. And it's just such a beautiful moment. And then, when something does happen, and I have heard like the big ice cracks, it's such a weird, distinctive, you almost kind of experience the sound more than just hearing it kind of a thing. That was good point. That it was very evocative, and I could really put myself in that situation.
I remember going to a friend's cabin when I was a kid, where in the summer, if you went to the cabin, it took hours and hours to drive to, because you had to drive around this massive lake. But in the winter, you just drove right across. And so it took a fraction of the time. But the entire time you're driving a vehicle over a lake, you can hear the ice cracking. Now, it's not cracking in a dangerous way. It's just kind of heaving and giving away a little bit. But it just sounds like it's like there's distant gunfire. That's what it sounds like from inside the car.
Yeah.
And,
Yeah, growing up in Jamestown, New York, we live right on the Chautauqua Lake, and it's like a 26-mile long lake, and growing up, it would freeze over every year, a little bit less so now, but they would always have an ice castle fest where they would saw out big blocks of it and make a giant ice castle, and I would, with my dad, walk out into the middle of this lake, and it would be pretty much right in the middle, so you would look up to just this incredible windswept expanse, like 13 miles one way, 13 miles the other way. And it would be just big cracks in the ice, just like you were saying, those were what would be kind of shifting. And we had airplanes landing on the lake a lot of times with that. And it was just like, that is kind of, man, you're really giving me the flashbacks now through this talk too. I don't want to get all emotional on this book, on Rama, a book that shouldn't really be invoking that kind of a thing.
No, but so one thing I guess I would say about Clark is that the ideas in his book are sometimes so big that even though the actual reading of it doesn't always evoke, you know, huge thoughts, I feel like talking about them, talking about the ideas that are presented is its own kind of reward. It's its own extended materials that you'd have on a Blu-ray, right?
Yeah.
So that's one thing I like about doing the podcast is we get to have that experience.
But, you know, cutting right to the end of the book, credit where credit's due, there is like a really interesting thing that they do on this is that And unfortunately, I think the sequels kind of walk away from what I think is the best element of this book, okay. that Rama had nothing to do with us.
Right.
It's heavily implied that all it was pit stopping in our solar system. That's why it didn't really stop or give a signal for like, hey, hop on board. Mm-hmm. It really was just a moment of opportunity. This thing didn't care about humanity at all. All the biots that we haven't mentioned at all, all the robots that formed in it, the reason they weren't interested in us is they just probably weren't even programmed to consider an intruder on the ship at that point. And that's just like something that I think in the book, we're awesome. We're dominating this solar system, doing really well. But in the end, whatever these amazing aliens are, we're completely still beneath their level of notice. They just didn't care. So it's like, and I think Clark does a good job of that, of like contextualizing and like, yeah, figuratively, people are in this tiny people in this enormous ship. And that's still us in the big scheme in space. And I thought that's like something that's really awesome that, you know, this ship wasn't for us. It had nothing to do with us. We are really still nothing in the big scheme of things.
Yeah. Well, since you went to the very end, I want to go back to the very beginning and just talk about the, you know, the hard science fiction element here is near Earth objects, which is a real thing. And that we have observatories that are looking around, you know, keeping an eye out for big flying things that could be a threat. And it seems like every couple of years we have one that, you know, passes within like the moon's orbit or close to it, which is freaky. I thought it was interesting that the impact that spawned the greater investment in the near Earth observatories happened on 9/11. That was fascinating.
Oh man, I missed that detail.
Yeah, September 11th. A big impact on Italy, I think it was.
Yep. Well, that's a yikes. Yeah. But yeah. But that's, again, that's one of those things that he just throws in these books of like, you know, Italy is absolutely decimated. He does the same thing in Fountains of Paradise, where it's like, how is this not just kind of the book all in and of itself? Like Fountains of Paradise is about a space elevator, but kind of out of nowhere, there's aliens that pop up in it for a little while. And just kind of have a cup of coffee in the book and then take off again. And it's like, what? It's like, all right, calm down. Maybe you don't have to put every awesome idea you have at once into one book and kind of focus it. But I don't know. It's just kind of perplexing at points.
Yeah. One thing that I find interesting about Clark is some of his writing makes me wonder. I haven't looked too much into what his personal life was like, but you know, in this one, we have Commander Norton has a wife on Earth and a wife on Mars and a whole family, and is considering one on Mercury or something at some point. And it's like, you know, a girl in every port kind of thing. Just makes me wonder what, you know, if Clark was unhappy just only being able to be married to one person at a time.
Well, I can give a little bit more insight into that potentially. But where I was wondering if like, because I don't think they overtly explained it, but how we are so spread across the solar system that time between travel is not super fast in this. There isn't the warp drive or anything. It looks like very relativistic speed. So maybe that's the reason that you're gone for so long at any point that, you know, morals have laxed or, you know, changed that. We're recognizing that, listen, you're going to be out in space for 5 years at a time before you come back to Earth. Yeah, I'm going to allow you to have a second wife out there and, you know, something here, maybe something like that.
Right.
I don't know.
And the post-mission orgy, too.
Yeah, that's a weird one. that was a weird thing. I'm like, I'm not entirely convinced that needed to be in this. But the, you know, 25-year-old me was probably more interested in that at the time of like, why don't we dive into that? Yeah. But so Clark, Arthur C. Clarke was at least bisexual and probably gay from my understanding. And he lived in Sri Lanka because he was in England during when they were castrating and, you know, arresting gay guys. So he went to Sri Lanka and I think lived more or less pretty openly gay. And I think he had a long-term partner there, because I think they had anti-homosexuality laws, but they just weren't really enforced. And he was like a major, major celebrity there.
Yeah.
So I think that kind of, you know, informs a bit in here, because there was one part that I thought was like, maybe in 1973, it should have been a little bit more overt, and this would have been a really clever way of getting it in a little earlier. But mm-hmm. when they are talking about Mercer and Calvert, two of the crew members on the ship, they are described as being completely kind of opposite people and like a weird couple guys to be friends with each other. Mm-hmm. And they're sent on a mission together, and it's explained, not through dialogue, more just as like the omnipotent narrator, that they share a wife together. And it's right. kind of very surprising. And then they describe it, and this is such like such a nerdy, hard science fiction, mathematical way of explaining something. They called the relationship an equilateral triangle.
Right.
Which when I read that, I'm like, wow, that's such a weird, interesting, unique way of slipping in that these two guys are gay or, you right. know, bisexual or complex sexuality or something like that. Mm-hmm. So I'm like, that's pretty cool. And here's where Ellen's in the book, like, they're not, nobody is a good character or a fully formed character. But I do like that Clark does throw in a handful of couple women characters. The main surgeon of the ship
right.
or is a woman. Like, I think it was the person who made the little sailboat was a woman. That they are very much just in line with everybody else, where they're all extraordinarily competent people.
Yes.
Everybody in this book, isn't it? They do their job and they do it well, damn it. It's yeah. it just super competent people. And it's not really made a big deal of in any real way. Mm-hmm. What Norton does make a couple sexist comments, but right, it's
about kind of,
yeah. But it's almost like, is that Clark or is that like a character flaw of him? But it's so kind of like not an overall, like, obviously there's a disrespect towards women systematically through this.
Right.
It's like, I'll kind of like let it fly of like, well, you know, space guy makes a sexist comment every once in a while, but he obviously mm-hmm. still respects her. And he had some sort of a meaningful, you know, beyond professional relationship with her, that it's not just implied, it's said, but it doesn't really go into it at all. This book has yeah. no interest in like really exploring connections between characters really at all.
Yeah. So one other thing that I wanted to talk about the way the book is a brisk read, right? It's not very long. It yep. really moves along. And there's, like I mentioned earlier, there's places where I feel like it could have diverted for a couple chapters and didn't. And one of those was kind of one of the most interesting hard science fiction sections was you had this scientist back on Earth who was like, hey, everybody, we're about to have some hurricanes in Rama. And here's why. And it's a very succinct explanation, just kind of goes into the Coriolis effect. And mm-hmm. I really, really liked that. And then the only problem was, I don't remember there being all that much consequence to the hurricane.
No, some of their stuff was blown around.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, they just kind of like, hey, thanks for the heads up. We're going to head upstairs and ride it out in the airlock.
Yeah.
You know, again, there's like so much of this that just is immediately should be cinematic. Mm-hmm. And it's just, man, I wish Clark had a little bit more of that turn of phrase to mm-hmm. make it feel very evocative or make me feel that pit in my stomach other than looking up pictures of artist renditions of this. It's like, mm-hmm. that's where I wanted to go through and like highlight like meaningful quotes for you to like maybe bring right. up. And then I'm like, oh wait, there's none. You know,
right,
there's like, there's the Mercer guy has like a placard on his desk that says like help stamp out bravery. And it's like as close as you get to a character thing for him. And like that, I guess that's quotable, but it's mm-hmm. like that's like the real negative of it is that you just don't get like that, the awesome action beat that gets your heart pounding reading a book mm. because there are plenty of those that do that. And yeah. it's just not this one.
So one thing though, that I feel like Clark with his background in science and his clear love for science, I like the fact that he lets the scientific process kind of not take a front seat, but at least kind of show how it works, where they note that there's a seawall on both sides of the sea, but on the south side, you know, the side that they're not parked on, it's 10 times higher. And so that from that, the scientists on Earth are like, well, okay, this thing must be capable of acceleration. And that seawall is taller because the seas would push up against it. And they, you know, they would flood that the entire land to the south of there if you didn't have that. And I just love that bit about how a hypothesis is formed, right? You kind of observe and you're like, well, here's a possible explanation for that, but we won't know until it happens, right? Where you have something like the neutrino, right? What was one of those things that was Heisenberg? I can't remember who it was, who was like, I think there's this particle, and we're probably never going to be able to measure it or to observe it. And, but it made sense of what they were observing. And then later on down the line, somebody observed it. And I just like that kind of notion of science can make those guesses and those informed hypotheses. And then later on down the line, it either gets proved or, you know, fails to be proved.
Yeah. I mean, that part is pretty satisfying because you do see people go through that and, you know, as a scientist, that's kind of the stuff that's bread and butter. And you do see that. Like, a lot of times the characters are right. It's like what you said with a hurricane. They give the example towards it and it's predictive. And, you know, much to the chagrin of the reader, you know, disasters averted. Like, it turns out that seawall, they were able to calculate the acceleration pretty much exactly when they see it dive into the sun later on. And it's like, nailed it. You know, it's like a lot of that kind of stuff coming in. So yeah, it's like what you said, it's like, that's one of the, when you look at Clark in general, I think that's something you can't escape. And I think it does come across is that he obviously was truly a lover of science and kind of extrapolating from where we're at to this kind of a stuff, where it does come across and you do kind of get uplifted, I think, by him sharing this stuff with you. And he did that. And my first introduction to him was like, the Discovery Channel doing the replays of like, Arthur C. Clarke's World of Mystery or something like that, you know, where it was just all these like scientific mystery things, kind of a little bit sensationalistic, but it was like, that was some of my first introduction to him. And I was always asking like, why in the world is he living in Sri Lanka? Because he always introduced it from that. So yeah, but the kind of maybe going back over to the characters, and this is just me shoehorning in another Aliens kind of reference. I think they do miss another opportunity here of introducing a little bit more of a drama or flavor to the book, because we don't get the Yaphet Kotto space trucker kind of characters that are out of their element, because like, man, what luck that they had to send this one ship of that's available at that moment. And it's all these, again, just wildly competent people. There's no one that's, you know, bringing up the rear. And it's like, this would have been the opportunity. Like, I don't need the Burke character, right? But maybe the one that's like screws up and hits the wrong button at a time kind of a thing. And hopefully that's not just cliched, but I think it gives you more flavor. That's like the best thing in Alien is just seeing these pack of just people that are half at each other's throats all the time, you know, that kind of a thing. And totally not here.
That brings to mind a Star Trek episode, the Next Generation episode, I think it's called Disaster, where the bridge ends up being isolated from the rest of the ship. And it's like Chief O'Brien and Troy and Ensign Roe have to decide whether or not to, you know, cut off the rest of the ship, right?
Yeah,
to
blow up the engineering section. Yeah.
Yeah, where you have Troy, who has rank but not experience. And yeah, something like that. I feel like if you were going to adapt this, you would have to bring in an element like that.
Yeah. And then, you know, changing pace again, there was this character, and I don't know. Correct me if I'm wrong. Listening to you're more religious than I am, it sounds like, right? I'm just stone cold atheist, whatever. I don't hold any religion against anybody. You know, it's all good. But when I read this, it's like, here's another interesting idea of like, man, somebody could dive into this of the communications officer, Boris Rodrigo, I think.
Yeah.
He was a member of this religious Christian faith with going out into space. Believers that, what was it? Christ was like an alien messiah, right? Kind of a thing.
Yeah, the cosmic Christers.
Right. And again, it's like going in my head of like, I don't know if it's hackneyed and cliched, but maybe the religious zealot, which he totally wasn't, as it turns out, will have some drama infused into this of like, this place is holy, how can we get into it? But again, not really played into it. And it's like, I wonder, like, it makes me wonder, like, what would a religious person think of this type of character or church kind of a thing? Because the book doesn't really go into it, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. No. And that's one of those things that as a religious person, it did stick out to me as like, well, does that make sense that that kind of a sect would emerge as humanity moved from a, you know, being just on one planet to being on several? I don't know. I kind of looked at it and I was like, until they discovered aliens, I'm not sure I can see it. You know, if there was some sort of life found, even microbial life on Europa or someplace, then I feel like you would have some, for lack of a better term, like evolutionary pressure on the religions of Earth to come up with a way to harmonize to that. And I'm not sure that's there at this point with humanity just being spread onto several planets, but not like another solar system.
Right. And it didn't frame it as if this is some fringe sect or anything like that. It sure sounded like this is a large movement on Earth.
Yeah. I mean, and you know, Clark being what Clark is, it's not like he gives you a panoply of what the religious status is on any of the planets. On the other hand, if such a sect existed and something happened like Rama that was obviously targeted to come into our orbit, you know, you kind of look at the privileged planet kind of view that you get from like the Discovery Institute and the intelligent design folks, where they look at Earth and they're like, what is it? The anthropic principle, right? The conditions on Earth seem perfect to give rise and to give rise to life and to support human life in particular. You know, I don't really hold to that kind of stuff, but I can see how it could be compelling. And so if you had this object just randomly in space, which is, as Douglas Adams said, really, really big, happened to come into our solar system, I can definitely see how people would be like, well, that was obviously sent by God.
I mean, again, not explained here at all, but it is a very interesting idea that's just kind of dropped in here. Again, it's like, I would love a book that looked at that really nuanced and intelligently and didn't just look at like, you know, how would an alien arriving impact religion? Like if it's, I think them, you know, religious people just revolting and being up in arms, I think would be kind of boring. I think it would be much more interesting to see how it would change things over time.
Okay. I heard you saying there that religious people are revolting. So, you know,
well, I'm taken out of context. How dare you?
Right. So on the other hand, largely true as well, because they're people.
Wow. Well, sure.
I will say though, that like, Childhood's End has that view, right? Where aliens show up and they're like, hey, by the way, all your religions are BS. And everybody goes, oh, right, I guess so. And gives up all their religions. And I'm like, I don't know.
Again,
I'm not sure about that.
A very optimistic view of like how humanity is.
Right.
Where it's like, so that's some of the stuff I like in Star Trek. And you see like the modern Star Trek's coming out. It's like, they're claiming it's not Star Trek when not everybody's perfect in it. I like seeing that. It's not where you end up. I like seeing the process of getting to that Star Trek ideal. That is so much more interesting than just everybody being, you know, what apparently now when we see in Star Trek Picard, people are like, they're phonies. I like seeing, you know, that process. It's so much more dramatically interesting. It's so many more opportunities for growth, obviously. So it's like, that's like I appreciate the big picture story that like the Clarkish type of author wants to get to, mm-hmm. but kind of maturing and growing as a person, I want to see that person struggle because it's the stuff I realize I struggle with. I'm trying to be a better person. You know, I'm now a people leader at work. Like I'm trying to change all the time how I handle this stuff. So I love seeing that now in people and in real life. And then obviously in like, you know, fiction.
Yeah. No, definitely. I'm with you on that. Everybody being perfect doesn't make for interesting fiction most of the time. And that's one thing I liked about Deep Space Nine, right?
Where oh, absolutely.
It wasn't just set in the Federation. You had a lot of non-Federation people there.
Yeah. And then going into that, when you are interested in looking at that type of thing, you go into the characters like Miles O'Brien, who had episodes where, like, was suicidal at points, something that the Roddenberry ideal would think is unimaginable, you know, or like Odo at points has, it's revealed that he had some really dark crap in his background and Kira did too. And the episode ends with them just kind of acknowledging they have these scars, this darkness in them. And it's just them staring at each other. And it's like, oh, that's so much better than like freeze frame. We're all laughing on the bridge at the end, kind of a moment. Right. Yeah. So it's like, yeah, I just crave that kind of a thing now, which man, I don't know. I think we've kind of gone through the action or lack thereof. Is it kind of like the final question I want to posed to you as a culmination of all this is when we go through and it's just like, this came after Ringworld. It's the way it's written. It feels like it's 50s, 60s, almost like some of these ideas, just kind of wrapping that all up in the end. Do you think this book stands the test of time and however you might want to interpret that?
Yeah. I mean, I don't want to be controversial for controversy's sake or anything, but I don't feel like it holds up very well. I mean, it's undeniably a classic, and I don't know. It is what it is, and I think I have to agree with you that I want to say it's of its time, but it's of an earlier time.
Yeah, right.
And so I don't know. There's a place for this sort of fiction.
Absolutely.
But, it's not my thing.
Yeah, that's the thing going into this. It's like, I did like it. And well, this is where I was like genuinely interested in your opinion, because I read so much just weird, forgotten to time paperbacks that show up, right? So I'm kind of like out of that loop of like really being able to tell if something stands the test of time, because I like reading the really dated crap almost a lot of times. I find it charming. So this is one of those ones where it's now like, I swear I knew what year it came out in. Like I could guess and I was totally wrong. So like what you said, it's a book of its time, but not of the time that it was written. That's kind of interesting. So like it is a bit of a time capsule. I think it still is important. I think we rightfully gave it praise where it's like, it has so many interesting ideas that you can do your own head canon around and pursue. But you just don't want to look at it for the book to give it to you a lot of times. And then I will say beyond this, avoid the sequels.
Okay. I was going to ask you about that because I haven't read any of them. And I know that not all of them are solely written by Clark, right?
None of them are after this. It's Gentry Lee takes over. And depending on the source, some of it's like, Clark just threw out ideas and the other guy, Lee, wrote everything.
Okay.
But then different, you know, reports say that, no, Clark was definitely more hands-on, which I don't think is the case because I did read Rama 2. And basically, I really disliked it. I don't want to say hate. That's too much anymore.
Yeah.
Because it takes so much of what I really liked about this, of that mystery. And throughout the rest of the series, they kind of get rid of that. The Rama intention is laid bare in front of you.
Okay.
And then on top of that, which I didn't want, this is one of those perfect books where it's like, it didn't need a sequel. The mystery, that last moment of like, hey, Ramans do everything in threes. that's a very cool ending to the
book. It's a great way to end it. Yeah.
Right. Which we probably should have given a moment of its own in our talk. But the the sequels kind of abandon a lot of the cool aspects, the best parts of this, I think. And then on top of that, for my money, when they do make an effort to put characters in, and then it's the way that you shouldn't do it. I think they're very kind of cliched love triangle type of situations where it's like it put in what we were saying was missing, but I don't think they execute it right. And then the stuff that I really love in this book, it goes away. So I don't think there's much. I mean, if you like those books, great, more power to you. It does go in a different area. So if this was a book that you found some good in, but you wanted more overt explanations, yeah, then those books are fine and they're good for you. Like them. I plenty of people do. I just say they're not quite for me. Right. Mm-hmm.
I will say that I was just scrolling through my notes here and I found a note that I had written that I think if I had read this when I was in college, when I was studying engineering, it would have blown my mind, right? It would have been exactly what I wanted to read. But, you know, at this point down the road from there, it's just not what I'm into anymore.
That's exactly what my situation was.
Yeah.
Studying biology, though, you know, or, you know, just wanting big thoughts kind of a thing. So, yeah, I think that's a pretty fair, honest rundown of this book. Mm-hmm. Where looking back, I can't say that I read any of the competitors for the year that it came out. So I can't say if I thought it was, if it earned the win. Yeah. There is a David Gerard book, guy who wrote like the Trouble with Tribbles episode, and he's written like one of my absolute favorite book series ever, the War with the Chitor books. So that might be like a spot where if I went and read his, I might have very strong opinions whether this should have won at all, maybe. But I can't honestly say I did all that much reading in this year. So
I've actually read the Man Who Folded Himself.
Which was
one of the nominees that year. That was an interesting one. It was a little crazy.
Yeah, that's a Gerard books. Yeah, he can get a little like, oh, we're going to go there? Okay, I didn't think we were going to do this. And I'm, you know, a book about fighting space worms. We're going to go down this route? Okay. And then it's crazy when he goes down those kind of tangents. It's a better book for it. But it's, yeah, he's an interesting guy. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, this is an interesting one. And, you know, like I said, I feel like this is the kind of book where if you read it and you have somebody you can talk to about it, it absolutely enhances the experience.
Yeah. And that's where I want to like really thank you for this opportunity to come on, because when I'm reading, like I read a bunch of books when I go on Goodreads and there's like a review for it. So it's like, who in the world am I going to talk to about some of these things I read? And then even something more like this, like where do you get the opportunity to like have this stuff? So being a fan coming in and having listened to a lot of the books that I've read before, it really is kind of like a fun proxy, but there is a bunch of times where I'm screaming into the void wanting to talk to you and your guest about whatever I'm reading. So this was like a great, thank you. A great opportunity to come on and like really talk about one of my passions is like science fiction literature and just have like longer form, more nuanced, you know, conversations about these books where we can be really honest and like you don't just have to say it's the greatest book and screw anybody who disagrees. It's like I really love to have that real fun conversation. Mm-hmm. I think that's increasingly lost in all aspects of fandom.
Yeah. Well, yeah. And I mean, through doing this podcast, there's been a couple books where like I came out of reading and I'm like, that didn't work for me. And then I have the conversation with somebody. I'm like, you know what? That worked okay, I guess. Just because having that time to mull it over with somebody who maybe liked it better than I did really does bring something up in my estimation and at least puts some positivity on the experience that I didn't always get from the actual reading.
So. Yeah. Because that's where I come at with books. If nothing else, I find them to be an experience. And if it's like a real crap early 50s book, at least I'm like, that was a charming, fun like look back. Yeah, it was bad. Yeah. But I'm not upset that I went into like the Wayback Machine and experienced something, you know, from a different era. And I am pretty good about finding a lot of worth from anything I read, usually, you know. Mm-hmm.
Cool. Well, I mean, I guess that kind of suffices for final thoughts, right?
Yeah, I would say so.
Alrighty. Well, if people want to get a hold of you, how can they do that?
So I, my Twitter handle is Pro Sub Zero, short for Professor Sub Zero. So PROSUBZERO. And then if you want to go back, this I think is a pretty good encapsulation of what we were trying to do, but looking at Star Trek Deep Space Nine. Mm-hmm. So if you want to go back and, you know, go through my backlog, it's all still up there. Upper Pylon 2, Star Trek Deep Space Nine podcast is part of the Trekmate family of podcasts. You know, swing by there where it's a lot of fun, long form conversations. And anytime I saw an opportunity to shoehorn in old science fiction into a Star Trek debate, I took it. So there might be a little bit of a crossover audience here. Like go listen to the episode where Sisko goes back to the 1950s where he was a science fiction pulp magazine author.
Oh, that's a good one.
Oh, it's one of the best. It's top two, three episodes, maybe most for me. Cause it's like when you kind of really know the history, you see what each one of the characters who they're portraying, like Carl Meany was Isaac Asimov. And like you go through and there are all these like famous authors, and it's such a perfect episode for the people who like me love these old books too.
Yeah.
And Star Trek, obviously.
Cool. That makes me want to go back. I'm going to have to resubscribe and pull down a few selected episodes just to refresh on them.
Go for it. Give us benefit of the doubt for the first few episodes. It was a learning curve. So
understood.
All right. So again, thank you so much. It was a lot of fun.
Yep. I agree. And thank you so much for joining me. I really appreciate it.
Absolutely.
For helping me fill out the catalog for when I'm away this summer.
Hey, as you can see, I'm not afraid to talk about these things. So if you see any other book that you need some help with, let me know.
Sounds good. Well, I'm sure we will see each other on Twitter and talk about aliens and Michael Biehn and all that kind of stuff.
Couldn't be happier.
All right. Cool. Take care.
All right. Again, thanks a lot.
Yep.
Have a good night. Bye.
Well, everybody, I hope you enjoyed that discussion with Matt, and I definitely encourage you to check out his podcast. And so I'll put that link in the show notes. Like I mentioned last time, my recordings are mostly remote anyway, so COVID-19 does not really affect the way I do things here. But like I mentioned at the top, I'm going to be releasing a couple sort of bonus episodes. They're regular episodes. I'm just going to be releasing them twice a month instead of just once a month. So of course, if you have a chance, if you're listening to more podcasts than usual right now and you haven't left a review for this podcast, I encourage you to do so. If you'd like to contact me, you can do that through the contact form on hugospodcast.com, or you can send me an email, feedback@hugospodcast.com, or follow me on Twitter @hugospodcast. And if you would like to, you can sign up to support at patreon.com/hugospodcast. But of course, if that's going to hardship you at all financially, I encourage you to not do that. And if you're one of my supporters right now and you can't be doing it, I have no problem with you deleting your commitment there. So I hope everybody's staying safe out there, and hope you enjoy the extra podcast the next couple months. And I'll talk to you next time. Bye. The theme music for the Hugo's There podcast was composed and performed by Tim Kuske.